following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
Here's Norman. You know, it's maybe there's one person that I can think of in my entire life that called me Normie. And nobody ever called me Norm.
Right.
It's odd because I've known other Normans that were Norms to lots of people.
Right.
I didn't necessarily use it, but other people did.
Who called you Normie?
His name, tennis player, a great tennis player, and my good friend, whose name I'm reaching for.
John McEnroe.
But it'll be, it'll run through my mind in the course of this conversation. And I'm going to come up with it. A Davis Cup player, doubles. He was in Davis Cup. And a great guy, and he called me Norm. He calls me Normie now.
Well, wait, do I remember correctly from, I think I remember from the book, from your book, even this I get to experience. Didn't the Mick call you Norm? Do I remember the quote, Mickey Rooney?
Oh, Mickey Rooney called me Norm.
The
yeah.
Mick.
Yeah.
You want to make a show with the Mick?
You want to make a show with the Mick? Listen, this was Mickey Rooney after I came to him with an idea for a show that turned out to be All in the Family. And he said on the phone, you want to do a show with the Mick? Listen to this. Vietnam vet, short, blind, private eye, short, blind, large dog.
Norm, you want to do a show with the Mick?
God, I love that. And, you know, I should repeat that when our guest comes, because he'll love that.
And we got a good guest today.
I've been fooling around because the guy is really across the table from us, even as we speak.
The illusion is blown. I'm here.
You know,
were you here the whole time?
He came into my life through a door marked impossible.
Oh my God, that's because, a song in that.
It really is. That's a line from like a Willie Nelson song or something.
Oh, I love it. And we were casting for One Day at a Time, another One Day at a Time. Everybody else was Latino, so that made it easy. We were not trying to replace Bonnie Franklin and so forth. But where Schneider was concerned, and the great Pat Harrington, around our words, invented that character. And we were looking for somebody to do that character. And somebody came in and didn't do that character and made Schneider his own. And I don't have the words to express how much I get from that, you know, to have seen it happen, a bit a part of it happening, and you know, I like surprises and miracles and goodnesses. And anyway, it's Todd Grinnell I'm talking about, who now plays Schneider. And yesterday we were picked up for a third season.
The One Day.
Congratulations!
And congratulations was just said by Todd Grinnell. Hi, Todd.
Hi. How are you? It's pretty great to be here, I gotta say.
Welcome.
It's pretty great to be here. Pretty great to celebrate season 3 with you.
How about that?
It's unbelievable.
I don't know why it took so long or how it happened that it took so long.
But this is a
celebration. It was worth waiting for.
Yeah, I couldn't care less now. I'm so just happy we're picked up.
Did you get a call? Is that how they call you?
I got a call at 20 minutes of 9 in the morning.
Did you?
To call a number.
I was going to ask how that happens.
To call a number at 9 o'clock.
Wow.
I knew it was a number related to the show. Brent got the same, and Mike and Gloria, the two head writers and showrunners, they got the call. We were all on the phone. We suspected from the invitation that it would be good news, but we didn't know for sure, and it was so late, anything could happen.
Yeah.
But my God.
Wow.
That's a good way to start
the
morning.
What a phone call to get.
Yeah, what a great phone call to get. Oh. And just that way, on a Monday morning at 20 minutes of 9, get a phone call. Call this number at 9.
It sounds like some, you know,
sort mafia.
Of yeah, exactly. Like show up at this phone booth.
Yeah.
Call. You'll talk to Saul.
And then he'll tell you where to go.
That's right.
So across from you, yeah. Todd, is my sidekick and buddy and partner here. What the hell is his name? Paul Hipp, who plays a mean guitar, writes a mean song,
really?
Sings a mean song, too.
Yeah,
you're a musician.
You're a musician, too, right?
Well, that's a very generous term. I have a couple guitars that I sit around and play on sometimes and sing to myself, but...
Then you're a musician.
Sure.
That's all it takes.
In my own living room.
You make a happy
noise. When
no
one else is around. Yeah. Well, it's happy to me.
Make a happy noise.
I don't know if it's happy to other people. But it's happy to me. It makes me feel good.
There's nothing you can do that isn't happy to other people. That's who you are.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I have a neighbor who
feels that. So there was a guy by the name of... Oh, God. I loved him so much. Pat Harrington. Who played Schneider.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, one of those... I'll never get over it. You know, you write a character, Archie Bunker, you write a character, Schneider. And some actor comes in and puts the words on like a wardrobe or something.
Yeah.
And you never knew you had, I don't know. It's a collaboration. Mm. It isn't your own. It's a collaboration. And then he comes in and he doesn't do that Schneider.
Yeah.
He does something altogether different, which allows, even pushes the writers to write more of what he could do well. Mm. So he influences the character from one show to another, from one script to another. He influences the character by the way he performs it.
Mm.
And the writing of it changes to accommodate the performance.
Yeah.
It's fabulous.
Well, thank you for saying all that. I mean, to me, it's interesting because when Gloria Calderon Kell and I have been friends for a long time, and I think it was, 2 years ago during pilot season, I got this audition sent to me, and I said, Schneider, One Day at a Time, and I knew she had been working on the show with you, and I was very excited for her because I was a fan of the show as a kid, watched it growing up, in syndication. I'll just preface, in syndication I was watching it.
I was looking at you thinking, you weren't watching
not quite
it the first
that
time
old.
Around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I called her and I said, did you arrange this? I've said this before. I said, did you arrange this or did my agents just do a really good job of getting me into an audition that I have no business being in? Because I know Schneider real well, and this is not – like I'm not that guy. And she said, no, we just – you know, we want to see what you do with it. Just, you know, we're seeing everybody. And she said, and, you know, it's the worst case scenario. You get to audition for Norman Lear. And I said, well, that's that sounds great. You know, that's worth the price of admission alone. Yeah. I'll just, you know, even if I tank it, it'll be great.
I auditioned for Norman Lear. What a line of bullshit. But,
yeah. Well, you know.
But I enjoy bullshit like anybody else. So.
Yeah, sure.
Only Norman Lear would think that's a line of bullshit. Any actor on earth would be very happy.
Let me blow a little smoke. I mean, you know.
Yeah, blow a little smoke.
A little smoke. But, it was... So it was kind of freeing, actually, for her to say, just come in. You know, it's kind of anybody's ball game at this point. You can do whatever. We don't know. You know, and I think you guys had looked at women for the role.
Yes.
And
wait, so I remember when you were in that process of casting that we had a cigar. Thank you. We had a cigar, and a couple times we got together during the process. And one time you were looking at women, and then another time.
Well, I do that.
You were looking, yeah, you're saying on in your process.
On a regular basis.
I mean,
you're looking at women. You were auditioning women for Schneider.
We did.
And and then the next week it'd be different. It would be, you know, there was a couple actors you mentioned their names and totally different. And and I went to the, watched the pilot being shot and I was like, oh, of course, that's the guy.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I mean, yeah, it's interesting though. When I first started, we did the first table read. I think this, the original, the table read script that we did was still the writing from, because I think you guys were thinking about maybe Schneider was really young.
Uh-huh.
So the writing was kind of written towards a younger guy. And I remember doing the table read and I was like, oh man, I just blew it. I just tanked this whole thing. You know, and I think Gloria texted, she's like, don't worry, we're going to change it. It's written for a younger guy right now. We're going to, you know, do some work on it. And then we started chatting a little bit about stuff and she asked me some personal questions and asked me if she could use some stuff for my personal life. And, you know, we did.
Oh, so all that stuff about your dad being a billionaire and all of that, all of that is real.
Yeah, that's all real. Yeah. It's all real. I've had 14 different moms, stepmoms.
And you have a 12-inch schlong?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
All that stuff is true. All of it's true. No, but some of, you know, there are a couple of things, you know, the fact that Schneider is sober.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that was from me as well. Which I'm saying publicly over a ginormous podcast, but yeah, you know, that's part of my life.
So you had a problem with booze?
Booze and drugs, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't had...
So it's interesting. I'm sitting here between two guys who have had this problem, because so did Paul.
Oh, okay.
And how many years ago did you start saving?
That's why you just
high-fived
me.
June will be... Gotcha. That's why I high-fived. Not to put too fine a point on it, but June 20th will be 27 years.
Wow.
Wow.
Congratulations. Happy birthday.
I was 27 when I got sober. So that'll be half my life.
Isn't that crazy?
Really crazy.
Yeah. That means you're allowed to drink again now.
Socially.
When you've doubled the time, you're good. Right?
Look, just control it. That's all you have to do.
He was starring on Broadway.
Yeah.
When you started to drink, I guess.
Well, no, I was because I've been playing clubs on Bleecker Street for a decade before where... You know, the gig is you get your booze for free and everything else. And so I was that just kind of put rocket boosters on my drinking and drugging.
Sure.
Because now I went from making $50 a night on Bleecker Street to starring on Broadway, starting in the West End and then starting on Broadway. So I had cash. So, you know, I was ready to go.
It's a good thing you made it out alive.
2 years of that show, making a good weekly wage, like money that I'd never even heard of people making, you know.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, I had no money left.
Right.
How's that happen?
Go figure. So bizarre.
Yeah, right?
So bizarre.
I guess that's the oldest story in showbiz, isn't
it? The oldest story in showbiz.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
It was money well spent at the time, though.
At the time.
Still here. You're still here.
I've lived through it. I worked with a half a dozen.
Yeah.
Well, maybe four.
Sure.
Know. Anyway, people who rate it real big.
Yep.
In shows I was involved with and who were in terrible trouble. I'm not talking about drugs. I'm talking about just, you know, people taking advantage and they're allowing it.
Yeah.
And broke at the end of it all.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's an amazing thing that my experience of it, there's certain aspects of that stuff that you can see, you know, you think you'd be able to see coming at you.
Mm-hmm.
But until it happens to you and you're taken advantage of, until it happens to you, maybe it's just me, but until it happens to you, you don't really think it could happen. Who would ever do that?
Yep.
Plus, you don't think, well, I've reached the point now where people are going to come try and take advantage of me. No, you're just kind of going about your merry way. And if you're drunk and coked up, you're a sitting duck.
Yeah.
You know,
if
you have the slightest problem, or if you're people, well, you know, showbiz people really, for the most part, I think tend to be nice and good.
Trusting, and also,
you know,
you don't want to assume the worst in people, and you also don't want to deal with it as an artist of any kind. I think, I mean, some people are great with numbers and money and all that sort of stuff, but you know, you want to be creative, you want to work on creative things.
Yeah.
And so, Todd, how old were you when this became a problem for you, drugs and alcohol?
Man, it was probably right out of the gate. I mean, I started drinking right around 13, 14.
Oh, wow.
You know, sort of behind my parents' back with friends and that sort of thing. And I think I knew I liked it a little too much right from the get-go. But also, something I romanticized. I think
there's
you used to see those ABC after school specials and stuff, and I for some there's something some sick part of my mind was like, that's cool,
right?
You know, like I used to watch Leaving Las Vegas in college over and over. I just thought Nicolas Cage was the coolest character in that movie, and people would come in and say, that movie's so depressing. Why are you watching? That guy is that's such a tragic, horrible character. And I was like, I don't know. I just find it invigorating. I got to watch this. You know, I just thought there was something cool about it. So I don't know. I think everybody romanticizes in some way being, not everybody. I did.
The wasted artist.
Being a barfly. Yeah.
The
you know, that
artist.
Sort of like Jim Morrison
William
kind
Burroughs
of thing. Yeah, exactly.
And
then you realize it's
when did
kind
you
of
know
BS.
You wanted to perform?
When do I know it? When I want to perform?
Yeah.
Man, you know, it was sometime around college. I think, you know, I grew up on the East Coast and
Boston. You were
outside of Boston, yeah. My mother's an environmental activist. My dad's a stockbroker. And in Massachusetts, you kind of grow up and you know, you go to good schools if you're lucky, and you kind of go banker, doctor, lawyer, that kind of thing. What's that?
You grew up in an area with 1,000 colleges.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's an intellectual hub. It's an academic hub, and so, you know, it's just not really something that I was exposed to. I was exposed to a lot of great art and museums and stuff like that, but it wasn't a career choice that people encouraged or I ever saw anybody making a living doing. It was just. There were these people on TV that they're kind of special and off there, and that's not reality. But it was. I went to college in Claremont, California, and I had a couple
Which
of friends.
One?
Pitzer College.
Pitzer.
Yeah.
I had a grandson that went to Pitzer.
Did you really?
From Pitzer 2-3 years ago.
Get out of here! I didn't know that. I love Pitzer. I'd still be there if I could. It was great. I didn't want to leave. That's funny. I'll have to get it.
And were you studying theater?
No, I studied history and political studies. I was going to go to law school.
Uh-huh.
And then I interned for an attorney in downtown LA for one semester. I took the train in and out from Claremont, and he was a great attorney and a great guy. And he would tell me, he's like, don't do this. You can do so much more. This is not fun. You know? Yeah. And I was like, wow. Okay. You're telling it's right from the horse's mouth. So then I decided I was going to go into politics, and I worked for a state senator. I moved back to Boston for a year after college, and I ended up working. I interned as a legislative aide to a state senator in Massachusetts, Steve Tolman, which was amazing.
Right.
But the whole time I was there, I was back in Boston. It's, you know, blizzard. I remember I was making copies at the state house one day and just watching outside. It was just white out blizzard, thinking about the friends I knew who were back in L.A. being actors.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you know, I'm 23. I gotta try this. I gotta go for it. You know, before because I can come back and be in politics later on if it doesn't work out. But if I don't give acting a shot, I'm never gonna do it. But it was kind of one of those things. I was like, it was like this little secret I had that I wanted to be an actor, but it was just something you'd not, you know, spending all this money on college and it just wasn't a career that I thought could be a career. And then
what happened?
I don't know. It just became a career. I don't know. I moved back to L.A. and I just started. I went to some acting classes and started hitting the ground and pounding the pavement. And
I
can't even tell you.
You should be doing something else.
No, I mean, when I left Boston, I started acting in Boston while I was working for the state senator, and I was doing little black box theater plays and a couple commercials here and there. I got my SAG card in Boston. I did a Stop and Shop commercial, which is a local supermarket. You know, I got my SAG card, and I thought, oh, my God, I got to get to L.A.
I got
my SAG card now. Like, I'm off to the races. I have hit the ceiling in Boston. You know, like, I'm too big for this town. Not really. I love Boston. And,
I did, too. I went to college there.
I know. You went to Emerson, right?
Emerson, yeah.
And you just had the guy from the lead singer from Passion Pit on, right, I heard?
Yeah.
Yes.
Michael, yeah.
Yeah, because they're Emerson guys, aren't they? Am I wrong
about that?
Yes.
Yes. Are you look you like you're guessing. All right. Move it along, Todd. Move it along.
Yeah, no, Emerson.
Case. Yeah.
Passion Pit.
Yes.
Great band.
Great band.
But did
great
we
band.
When we were you were
Yeah,
you,
I think we touched on
talked
that.
To,
yeah.
About Emerson.
Anyway, so so I left Boston and just kind of, you know, I packed up my car and moved to LA, and it was, I think, a pretty classic actor story of, like, you know, you wait tables and go to acting classes and pound the pavement and go to all these auditions out of Backstage West and, you know, do the thing. You know, you just kind of hustle. And
sell your body.
Sell your body. You know, it's a long... It's just, not, it, you know, it still the, not make a lot of money.
What was the first
thing I ever did?
That you would call a break.
The first big break I had, you know, I was waiting tables at Chibo on Sunset.
Right.
Good friend of mine owned that place. And I'd done a little bit of theater, but I got an audition for a NBC pilot in like 2005. It was one of the first TV pilots that I ever got an audition for. But I had been in class for so long and studying. I just wanted to be on a sitcom.
Right.
I grew up on them. That's really all I wanted to do is just be on it. You know, some guys I think move here and they're like, I want to be James Dean. Yeah. You know, and I'm like, that's not me. You know, I'm like, I want to do what John Ritter did, you know, and Dick Van Dyke, those guys. So I got an audition. I heard about this audition that they were casting four guys for this NBC show. It was by the creators of Will and Grace. And I had a very small agent at the time. And I walked into her office with the breakdown on a piece of paper that I had printed off from somebody else's computer. And I said, I need to get an audition for this. Get me in there, please. And they luckily had seen everybody and their brother. I mean, they had gone through 1,000 people. So it was, you know, they were kind of open to a phone call from somebody, and I got in for the audition and ended up, you know, auditioning for it eight or nine times until I convinced them that they're, you know, I needed to do this. And it was...
They really call you in the...
I read a lot.
Times.
I read a lot. Yeah, I read a lot. I think I tested a few times for it. But there was, you know, because they were trying to mix and match the four different guys. Right. But it was a show called Four Kings, and it was a sitcom by the creators of Will and Grace, David Cohan and Max Muchnick. And it was myself and Shane McRae and Seth Green and Josh Cook. And it was a blast. It was
right.
I literally went from waiting tables one night. And the next day I was, you know, on the soundstage watching a Will and Grace rehearsal with Max going, now watch this because you have to do this next week.
And were you drinking then?
No, I had been sober by then. Uh-huh. Yeah, I got sober a couple years after I moved to L.A. because I took an acting class and I started to get I had this kind of epiphany after a few years of being in LA and just drinking and partying and kind of being an actor that, you know, there, you hear these great stories of like the old greats. You hear stories of like, you know, Richard Harris getting drunk and still going out and, you know, delivering Shakespeare and doing all this amazing stuff. And I'm just not that guy. If I'm drinking, I'm not leaving the house. I'm just kind of a mess. And I realized that to be a professional actor, I needed to dedicate a lot of time and energy and focus, and I was not going to have the career or life that I wanted if I was living the way I was living. So I quit drinking. So this luckily came at the, you know, it was
did
a few
you
years
join
after.
Something to help you?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I did. You know, I mean, it's a somewhat anonymous, situation. So yeah, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Would it be among the first listings in the telephone book?
It probably would be.
Oh,
it probably would be.
Interesting.
So these two.
But yeah, you know, because I don't think anybody does anything without help.
Are you maintaining personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, film, and podcasting?
Well, that's what I'm thinking about right now, and I'm realizing I'm probably not.
We've all kind of walked that edge of that anonymity line.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. but yeah, it was.
You had some help. I had some help.
Yeah.
Some fellowship.
I had some fellowship. I had some help from some other people who share the same issue and still do to this day. You know, I've been sober for over 16 years and best thing I ever did in my life.
And you go weekly to a meeting.
Oh, yeah.
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 I admire that so much. I mean, it's so clear that it has worked miraculously for so many people.
Yeah.
And continues to.
Yeah, it's you know, I'm not a joiner of groups, really. I don't like holding hands and all chanting same stuff. You know, I'm not a big organized religion guy. It was hard for me in the beginning to kind of ask for help and be part of a group, but it's been invaluable to me.
Was it hard for you too, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, same story. And then you find out, if you stick around long enough, that you're so not unique
That's right.
Right? Don't you? You find out that you have just joined a group of people who do not want to belong to a group of people.
That's right.
Who do not want to hold hands.
Yeah.
You know, and then they say the thing about, I always have, like, if I'm helping somebody that's new and they talk about, you know, I have a real problem with this God thing. Oh, I better call central office. We've never had one like you before.
Yeah.
You have a problem with the God thing, a room full of alcoholics. You don't think everybody in there has a problem. So it's funny you find out just how, and sometimes, and then, a big thing for me was when I walked in and I thought, they put this speaker up to this. This guy's telling my story.
Right.
This can't be real. Did my friends tell him this shit to say?
Mm-hmm.
And then you find out, no. And guess what? That's his story. A, the world doesn't revolve around you, so forget about your story. We're all the same. There's
That's right.
You know.
Yeah. First meeting I ever went to, I walk in and there are 200-300 people in this church, you know. It's all... They're all happy and beautiful, and I'm sitting there sweating through my shirt with bags under my eyes and all bloated because I just come off of a 3-day bender or something.
Mm.
And the guy who spoke was a 5'2" gay ballerina, Latino guy from Hollywood, which is, you know, on the surface, kind of the opposite of me to a certain degree.
Mm. In what town was this?
We were at a meeting in Beverly Hills.
Oh, here.
But he spoke for 20 minutes, and I was jaw on the floor. The guy told my story.
Yeah.
I was like, there's no reason why we should really relate to each other in a lot of ways if you just look at the surface of it. But, you know, as human beings, we are the same.
Yeah.
You know, and you are telling me everything you've experienced. I relate to every second of it, you know? That's when I knew. I was like, I'm here. I can't. This is what I got to do now.
Until then, you think you're the only one on the planet.
That's right. Yeah, because we're isolationists.
And the shame and the guilt and the horror show that is.
Yeah.
And then you walk in and then somebody's talking about there's the same thing as you and other people are laughing.
I know.
Because they're identifying with you. Well, laughter.
Oh, the
this
stories.
This is shame and horror.
The stories and the humor that come out of those rooms.
Yeah.
It's the...
I always say to people, it's where the badass survivors ended up.
Yeah.
You know, the badass survivors.
Yeah.
So when did... when did you start thinking about what resulted in the granola bars?
Yes. You're talking about this bar saves lives.
It's fantastic. I was just reading about it.
Oh, you were? Cool.
Yeah, great.
Our company's called This Bar Saves Lives. We are a social entrepreneurship company. We're a give-back company. So for every gourmet granola bar we sell, we provide life-saving food to a malnourished child somewhere around the world. If you've heard of Tom Shoes or Warby Parker... there's a bunch of give back companies around now. It's, you know, it's a relatively new thing in the last, you know, whatever, 10, 15 years. But, I was an actor in LA after Four Kings ended. It was that was my first big break, but we did 13 episodes and it went on and off the air pretty quickly. And, I was of course heartbroken and looking for work afterwards. And I was sitting at home one day and I remember watching the news. Like I said, my mother is an environmental activist. In Massachusetts. So I grew up going to protests. We used to get arrested together. She was an environmental activist, but primarily trying to shut down a nuclear power plant that was about 25 miles away from where we lived. And so, you know, I'd go to marches in fifth grade. I went to a march with her and all these, you know, hippie New Englanders, and we all hopped the fence at the nuclear power plant, had a sit-in, and we're singing Crosby, Stills, and Nash songs, and then the police came in with a school bus, and, you know, I just learned about civil disobedience because I was reading Thoreau and Walden and stuff, and, my mom said, okay, here's your chance, practice civil disobedience. So I just sat there, you know, and the cops dragged me away. It was an interesting, you know, it's just interesting. She taught me a lot. It's an interesting way to grow up. So in any case, I grew up and I'm an actor now and I'm sitting around LA kind of moping because my sitcom got canceled. And I remember turning on the news and I'm seeing Anderson Cooper, you know, embedded somewhere. And I was just like, I'm not connected to the world. I'm not doing anything for the world. And that's a huge part of what I was taught when I grew up is, you know, you got to get out there and be a global citizen, do something, you know, be a part of your community, give back. And so at that point, I decided I ended up working for a nonprofit. I wanted to work with kids, and I wanted to work internationally. So I started working with this nonprofit where we were getting medical care for kids in Well, anywhere really, but it was all primarily West Africa. We'd find medical care for find kids who needed some sort of life-saving surgery in West Africa, and then I'd find doctors in the U.S. Through other people who would help take care of them for free. We'd bring them. So I'd fly over to Africa, pick up a child who had some crazy, awful thing that they needed fixed, and we'd fly back and bring them to Cincinnati Children's Hospital, and doctors there would fix them up for free, which was amazing, and somebody in Cincinnati would put them up until they were recovered, and then we'd fly them back home. So it was almost like the reverse of Doctors Without Borders.
That's great.
It was.
And so you go to like Guinea, Liberia?
Yeah, it was all. It was primarily Cote d'Ivoire and Liberia.
Yeah. Wow.
And so on one of the trips, you know, it's amazing. I'd never been to Africa before. I always wanted to go. And, you know, it was kind of pitched to me that like, oh, yeah, this is great. We need escorts for the kids. We'll take care of everything. You know, you guys go. And I was like, great, I love kids, I love to travel, this is great. And it turned out like, no, you've got to fundraise, it's a lot of work, you know, it's a big, huge responsibility. I mean, I would fly back with kids sometimes. There was a baby I had to fly back with who was only, I think, 6 weeks old at the time, but had such a severe cleft lip that he couldn't nurse and was starving, was just dying, wasting away. And there was concern that he would die on the plane with me on the way back to the States. So, you know, like that kind of, it's insane to me now that I did it, because it's insane that these mothers would hand me their kid, this American guy who didn't speak the same language as them, but they were so desperate, and, you know, they were willing to.
What happened with that particular kid?
He ended up, he was fine. He had, you know, he came back, we made it. I saw pictures of him. And I need to get some new pictures, but I saw pictures of him after his surgery, and he just was like all smiles, just super happy. Because a lot of the times it's birth defects that we fix in this country, like right in the hospital before you go home, and that they don't have the means to in those certain areas.
When they hand you the kid, is it you and the kid on the flight, or is it a nurse? It's just you?
No, it's just me and the kid.
Wow, you're
a
good
guy.
Yeah,
it was crazy. It's a little terrifying at certain points.
I'll bet.
But at the time, you know, you're kind of just – there's adrenaline, and you're just kind of like, we're doing this. Like, this kid has no other option, and I just kind of have to – you just buck up and just do it.
You get off the plane, you talk to your wife or somebody, and they had already arranged for a doctor to see the child.
Yeah, we had made arrangements beforehand for the kids to come have – you know, like, we'd have foster – I worked with another woman in Ohio who had set up foster care, and the doctors in Ohio, so I was kind of the intermediary. So I'd usually meet somebody at the airport who would pick them up and take them to their house, and then they'd go take them to all the hospital visits. And those people, those people do a lot more than I did to put a child up for 3 months or 6 months and take them back and forth to all the hospital visits, to the surgery, to the aftercare. Like, those people are saints, you know?
I'm going to Africa and finding the kid in the first place. Well,
I appreciate that. But it's also selfishly, it's an amazing experience. You know, I mean, it's an incredible thing. But in any case, on one of those trips, I happened to go with another actor friend of mine, Ryan Devlin. We went to Liberia on a separate project from the kid stuff. We were helping to rebuild a bridge for some villagers in Liberia who had been cut off from civilization because their bridge got blown out. So we raised a bunch of money and went to Liberia and oversaw the ending of the building of this bridge. And while we were there, we had a free day and we toured a refugee camp. And it was all refugees who were displaced by the Liberian Civil War in I think 2005, 6, 7, somewhere around there. And they had a malnutrition clinic at this refugee camp. And Ryan and I walked in because we were just literally just on sort of like a tour. Mm-hmm. And there were about 20 mothers holding infants who were wasting away, literally about to die. I mean, it's the awful pictures that you see on the news, you know, of kids just who are skin and bones. And they had previously been brought back to life with something called Plumpy Nut, which is a life ready-to-use therapeutic food. It's basically peanut paste that's fortified with vitamins and protein. And you can rip it open and just feed it to a child. And it lasts for 2 years. And it doesn't have to be mixed with water, refrigerated, or cooked. So it's really easy in developing countries to just – and it's like 2 or 3 a day for 7 to 10 weeks – takes a kid from almost dying to just being a fat, healthy baby.
Wow. And what would that cost? Like the equivalent of,
I mean, it's like
$10?
No, it's like a box. It's about 150 sachets of Plumpy Nut, as they say, is sort of like the regimen that a kid needs. So that's one box per kid. That'll save their life. And it's roughly like a quarter for a packet of right. Plumpy Nut, something like that. So in any case, Anderson Cooper had just done a piece on Plumpy Nut on 60 Minutes a few months before. And I said, Ryan, oh, my God, that's that stuff that Anderson Cooper was talking about in 60 Minutes. Amazing. You know, like, you have to check it out. Watch this piece. It's so cool. Because they're calling it a miracle cure for the malnutrition crisis. So we thought it was – I thought it was so cool that it was being used in real life in front of me. It was inspiring. And but the guys who were running the camp said, yeah, it's great, but we only have like two boxes left. And I said, what? There's 20 kids in that room. Where's all the Plumpy Nut? And they said, you know, where the Liberian Civil War ended, there's a lot going on in Darfur and South Sudan right now. And so – UNICEF's got all their money earmarked towards those places, and they're just not, they don't have the resources to send us some. And, you know, we can only afford to buy so much, so we're just running out. And Ryan and I just thought, that is crazy. This is the craziest thing. Kids are dying. This thing is so simple and so effective, and we know the cure's right there. They just need it. Like, this is insane that they don't have it. So anyway, we came home and we tried to fundraise, and We tried to think of all these different things that you know, we'll hold the fun, we'll hold the concert, you know, we'll hold the party, we'll get, but the thing with fundraising is that you have to do it all the time. You know, once you ask all your friends and family for money, then the next month you have to do it again. And we couldn't figure out a way to create a long-term sustainable funding source for Plumpy Nut for this refugee camp. And then at that time, Ryan read Shameless Exploitation in Pursuit of the Common Good, which is a book by Paul Newman's business partner. You probably know him. I can't remember his name.
I did
He's got
know
a great
him,
name.
I can't even remember the name, but I did
yeah,
know him.
I'm sure you did. He's, I mean, the book's great. But, you know, that was Newman's Own is arguably the first and largest sort of give back company there is. And at that time, Tom Shoes was becoming popular and Warby Parker. And we kind of got inspired by all these things. And Ryan said to me, let's start a one-for-one company. Let's start a give-back company where we sell granola bars and we'll give Plumpy Nut. And I was at a point in my acting career where it was after a pilot season. And I hadn't gotten a show. And I was feeling like I need to do something with my life that's responsible, you know. So we started the company. And now, you know, that was probably 8 years ago. And now we're in Starbucks and Whole Foods. And
wow.
That's fabulous. And it's called?
This Bar Saves Lives.
This Bar Saves Lives.
Yeah, it's an audacious title, but we wanted it to be obvious.
Right.
But even saying that, a lot of people then go, well, I don't get it. What does it mean? So then you pick it up and the back of the wrapper says exactly what we do.
Right.
But we wanted something, you know, it's funny because Ryan and I were sitting around one day and we were like, oh, let's call it, what's the Swahili word for give? Or let's, you know, Love Bar. Because all granola bars are like, one word plus bar. It's like Cliff Bar, Kind Bar, you know, all these different things. And so we were trying to come up with some cute African
inspiring. This Bar Saves Lives you came up with.
Yeah. Well, that was the tagline. And we went home and both of our wives said to us, you guys are being stupid. The name is This Bar Saves Lives. Just call it This Bar Saves Lives. And I came in the next day to the office and I said, I don't know. My wife said this thing. She thought it should just be This Bar Saves Lives. And Ryan said, my wife said the same thing.
Yeah. So, and by the way, besides having a good name and doing going to a very, very good cause, they taste really good.
Oh, dude, thank you. Yeah. I'm glad. We spent a lot of time on the recipes.
Starbucks, yeah.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad. We'll get them. They've been on set at One Day at a Time, but we'll get them. Maybe not when you've been there.
I've never had one.
Yeah, we'll get more of them. We got to keep the show in big supply. Thank you.
And plus, my nickname in high school was Plumpy Nut.
Oh,
what are the odds? I made that up.
Well, that's a great. I mean, it's good. I like that. I like that.
There's no reason why Marcel can't come home with a bar and talk about it.
That's right. We did have them on the show at one point. I can't remember. I think.
And you talked
about
it?
Well, they were just in an episode. Uh-huh. We didn't talk about it, but we'll figure something out.
Oh, yeah. Work it into the show.
Yeah. They were used as a prop last year. I think when Elena went on the march. During the Doctor Who episode, maybe one of those episodes, we had him as a prop. But yeah, you know, one of the things we took away from Paul Newman's book was
A.E. Hotchner.
Yes, that's the guy. A.E. Hotchner. What a great name.
Yeah, right?
That guy.
Yeah, which I always pronounce Hockner.
Oh, okay. Well, Hockner's cool, too.
That's what I said, A.E. Hockner.
Yeah.
He said Hotchner.
Come on.
God,
that's the way I thought it would be pronounced. Having read it only, I've never heard.
No. Both ways make sense, but Hockner does sound.
Yeah. Like, I think it's one of those kind of names you can say it any way you want.
That's true. But Paul Newman in that book said, he said, you know, I knew everyone would buy this salad dressing once because my face was on it. But the only way they would buy it a second time is if it was actually good. And so he made great salad dressing. I mean, right. That guy, you know, it became about because he made salad in his bath in a baby pool with a canoe paddle in his basement in Westport, Connecticut. And he would give the salad dressing out as like Christmas presents to his friends. And he just loved making salad dressing.
Really?
Yeah. Like
what an odd thing.
He thought that he only liked his own salad dressing.
Right.
Like, he just thought he made the best. Whatever. I'm sure he respected other people's salad dressing. But when he went out to restaurants, he would bring his own salad dressing.
He brought his own salad dressing.
Yeah.
I did that with him.
You son of a bitch. Really?
And he thought, there was a period when I went to the, where was the racetrack? It was about an hour and a half drive.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought I could race. My personality, something about me was I would make a good driver or a good race. And I loved driving.
I see that.
So we drove to this where he had a couple of cars and a team. And they got me to a place where I took the car alone a couple of times. And he was so – this is one of the good – of guys, but he thought I was going to make a real great driver. I had a problem he didn't know about. And the problem was, as much as I liked being with him, loved being with him, I hated the 90-minute drive to the place and back. I hated all that much time in a car.
They're always
and
out
he
in the
loved
middle
it.
Nowhere.
He was driving.
Sure.
And so he loved every second of it.
I didn't know you guys were
But did
friends.
You enjoy racing around the track?
Oh, I did. I felt like a great athlete.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I got out of the car and going around the track twice.
Yeah, and your confidence builds, right, as you go around.
Yeah, I've done it once.
Yeah, it's great
it
fun.
Is. It's funny. We did my wife got my brother and I for my birthday a couple of years ago some laps around one of the tracks out by Pomona or something down here. And we were watching the first crew of people do it who were all like us, you know, and I was sitting there talking smack going, these guys are going so slow. This is embarrassing. I can't wait to get out there.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, when you're driving, you think you're going a million miles an hour. And she showed me the video. I mean, it looked like we were the pace car. just putt, putt, putt. And the whole time I'm just like shaking with adrenaline thinking it's like I'm going forever.
Right.
Anyway.
This bar saves lives. Where are they made?
We have a couple co-manufacturers that we work with. One's in upstate New York. One's in Nashville.
Uh-huh.
We buy all of our ingredients come from different places around the U.S. And we manufacture at those two facilities, and then we ship it out and sell it all over the place. We're at Whole Foods and Target and Amazon and Starbucks, and we're the new granola bar in Delta Airlines.
Oh wow!
That's a lot of bars you're selling.
Yeah, we're making we've sold, you know, I forget what they're like, about 3.5 million.
Wow!
It's funny. When we first started the company, we said, you know, we're not gonna measure our bottom line in dollars. I mean, of course, we have a CFO we have numbers and all that stuff. But for us, just as the way we think about it, because a bar sold as a packet donated, that's how we measure it, you know? So instead of saying we've sold 3.5 million bars, we talk in the sense that we've given over 3.5 million sachets of life-saving food to malnourished kids, you know, and that's enough to
help. Is that the ratio?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it's 1-to-1.
That's amazing.
So, you know, we've helped reach, I think if my math is right, over 270,000 kids.
Wow.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. How many countries?
I mean, we get Haiti, Mexico, Philippines, South Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, all over the place. Probably 10 countries. Yeah, we're partnered with Action Against Hunger.
Okay.
Well, a bunch of different NGOs, but Action Against Hunger is our biggest partner, but also smaller ones, too. We're partnered with a great organization in Haiti called Second Mile Haiti, which was started by two women who went there on a humanitarian mission trip with their church years ago and decided to stay and start their own thing. So they've created this, like, they've leased land and they've built these homes, you know, dormitories basically for moms who have malnourished kids, and the moms bring their kids there and they nurse them back to life with the Plumpy Nut that we provide. And then while they're there, they teach them business skills and farming skills and nutrition skills. It's like a real holistic approach to it, which is what we love. You know, that's what we want to do. So, but they're a very small, you know, compared to Action Against Hunger, they're a very small organization, but for us, it's amazing because we get to go to Haiti. I mean, I've been there a couple times, and we take our whole team there once a year because Haiti's actually not that far to get to.
How big is that team?
We've got about 15 or 16 people in the office, but then we've probably got 6 to 10, you know, outside contract consultant type people too, who are, you know, do amazing work for us.
So you had to have learned a business as you were creating a business.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And you learned it as you created it.
Yeah, it was trial by fire. I mean, it was partly because I think Ryan and I brought on a couple friends, Ravi Patel and Kristen Bell were the first people we gave our business plan to, and they both said, "This is amazing. I want to be a partner. I don't want to invest. I just want to be a partner." And, you know, so it's the four of us. The four of us really started it. None of us had started a business before or anything in that way. So we really had to just kind of, I think because we were all actors, we didn't have ego about what we didn't know. You know, I would just go up to anyone and say, "I have no idea how to do this. Can you help me?" You know, and we would all say that, and we just kind of kept asking for help.
But the suggestion being actors are free of ego?
No, that's a great distinction. Free of ego in this sense. Also, because of our mission, I think, you know, it was like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. We're just trying to feed kids. So help us out.
That's amazing.
You know, and people really respond to that. And, you know, it was easy to ask for help.
And why health bars? Like, how did you come up with that?
Just because it's the closest sort of, if you look at a pack of Plumpy Nut, it's essentially, you know, foil full of ground up nuts, you know?
Great.
So
it's
we
so
were
poetic.
Like, that's the closest, you know, if you're doing a one for one type of thing, it's the closest thing to it.
Do you have a patented recipe?
Well, Plumpy Nut is, we don't make Plumpy Nut. Plumpy Nut is there's a company called Nutriset. They're French and they've got a bunch of franchisees around the world. And so that's its own thing. We work with an organization that produces Plumpy Nut, but, our recipes are, I mean, I don't think they're a patent.
Yeah.
It's a secret.
Yeah, but just
it's a secret recipe.
And you'll kill anyone who knocks it off.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But it's, you know, it's nuts and fruits and it's all held together by
glue.
You know, honey and nice things, and it's non-GMO project verified and gluten-free and you know, all the stuff that people want. It's lower sugar, higher protein. Yeah, we do. We try to do as much marketing as possible. We're always getting out there and doing stuff. You know, Kristen's been really helpful with a lot of our marketing because she's got a huge voice. You know, and she's such an amazing philanthropist. I don't know if you've had her on here before, but she'd be an awesome person to talk to. You know, we've had some great marketing opportunities, and that was one of the things we knew as. We have no idea what we're doing to start this business, but we are actors in Hollywood and we have friends who have big voices, and maybe we can, you know, ask for some free marketing from some people once in a while. And so, you know, people have responded to the mission and you know, said nice things in public places about it, and that helps. But that's my granola bar, guys.
That's amazing that you did that. I went over to that part. I was in that part of the world and went to Guinea.
I've always wanted to go there.
Yeah, and we went out to some refugee camps and met some of those Liberian refugees. What an eye-opener that was, that experience. But I didn't start it. I'm inspired by your activism.
Thank you. Well, it's...
Oh, my God, it's inspirational.
No, because you'd always do more. I went over and did and helped as much as that, but I didn't even come close to what you're doing.
Well,
you're making a real difference.
And you also,
your
youth,
appreciate
got arrested with
you.
Your mother.
Yeah,
I talk all the time about, you know, at my age, as much as I've been involved, I've never been arrested.
Really?
I'm looking forward to getting arrested.
Oh, yeah. We can go get arrested anytime you want.
I want to go. Let's go to a protest and get arrested.
This is not a hard thing to do. It's incredibly easy.
Well, it's been a hard thing for me. I just never have. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I have not been in situations where police were, grabbing us by the collar.
I mean, that's probably a good thing. It's probably a good thing. Although I feel like, you know, it's amazing to me that there's been so many marches and so many rallies lately that, I mean, if you look at the Women's March and the March for Our Lives, so many marches. I mean, there've been some rallies that have resulted in a lot of violence. But
listening to them, they're fabulous.
Yeah, those kids are
unbelievable.
They're amazing. We're all getting shown up by high school kids.
Yes.
Well, and good.
And that's a great thing.
Well, I was talking to a friend of mine on the way over who's a Republican. And we were having a conversation on the phone. And I said, let's forget politics. These kids, and forget if you're, you know, the kids that were marching the other day, so civically involved and so well-spoken.
Yes.
I said, can you imagine that? Now, forget politics. Forget what you think is right. Can you imagine what we look like to them? Like lunatics, just at each other's throats, like crazy people. And they're going to change that, and I believe they will.
Well, also, it's like, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of high school kids going, you guys are blowing it. You are not getting it done. We're going to do it.
Yeah.
And they're getting it done. I mean, they're making a huge difference, and that is amazing.
I've never been more take over, kids. It's like the line in the song "What a Wonderful World," where he says, "I see babies
cry. What a wonderful world.
I see babies cry. I hear babies cry.
I see babies cry.
I'll watch them grow.
I'll watch them grow.
They'll learn much more.
Than I'll ever know.
And I say to myself,
here it is.
What a wonderful world. That's as good a thing to close with as anything I know.
I like it.
Well, you know what makes the world even better is besides the granola bar, which I think is just brilliant and wonderful and couldn't respect it more.
Thank you.
You as a performer. In One Day at a Time on Netflix.
Season three just picked up.
Playing a role that everybody who knows that show remembers.
Thank you.
And you've made another Schneider out of it.
Thank you.
And I, for one, just stand in awe. Sitting in awe.
To hear you say that to me is pretty humbling. I stand in awe of you, my friend.
I stand in awe of both of you.
You are sitting, but that's okay.
Yeah. Now let's go have a social drink. We just control it.
We didn't even get a chance to talk about One Day at a Time. But
what a wonderful world.
And I say to myself,
lead us into that. What a wonderful world.
I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know.
And I say to myself, what a wonderful world. This has been All of the Above with Norman Lear and our guest Todd Grinnell and the great Todd Paul.
Todd Paul. Paul Hip.
Paul, God damn it. Remember my name.
The guy at the other end of the table. Thank you for having me.
Blessings.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Hip.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
Hi, everybody. This is Susie Orman, and soon we'll be launching my new podcast, Women and Money. Don't you miss it. On the show, besides having a lot of fun, we're going to answer financial questions from listeners, and maybe, just maybe, we'll even put you on so we can have a chat. Wouldn't you just love to talk to me? So be sure to check out Women and Money on Apple Podcasts, podcast1.com, and the new Podcast One app.